Hey there, welcome to LSAT Demon Daily Digest. I'm Ben Olson, that's Nathan Fox. Together we're the founders of LSATdemon.com and our weekly podcast, Thinking LSAT. Here's what we talked about this week. We have an email here from Lexi. She has three questions for us.
Hello, what do you think of the following strategy? Read an RC paragraph, cover it up with your hand so you cannot reference it. On a separate piece of paper, try to reproduce and write down what it said.
Absolutely not. No, please.
She goes on, paraphrase in a way that would not change the meaning of the original text significantly. The idea behind this strategy would be to increase your skill at recalling accurately and interpreting what was actually said. Do you think this would enhance your ability to read a text and not impart outside information onto it, possibly improve your short-term memory? Thanks, Lexi. Ben says, absolutely not.
I hate the idea of trying to reproduce it and write it down.
Me too.
Not going to do that on the actual test. What I do, okay, so in your in all these steps, you mentioned paraphrase in a way that would not change the meaning of the original text significantly. I think I do this all the time as I'm reading. I'm reading, pausing. I'm sometimes looking up to the sky, which I've read is a literal sign, not just a metaphorical one of someone thinking. People, when they think, okay, they tend to look up, you know? Not that you need to do that by any means, please. I'm not suggesting that people do that. I just noticed that I do that. I'm reading it and then I look up and I'm thinking about what they said. And part of that is understanding what they said. And part of that is paraphrasing, restating what they said in words that I understand, that confirm to me, that sum up essentially what their core points are, right? Because a lot of these things, they're long and wordy. And it's like, okay, yeah, I get what you're saying. You're basically saying that we used to have a drought in this area, and now we don't any longer. And there are some people who have a theory about why that is. Okay, what's that theory? I'm ready for you now, right? But the point here is that I'm paraphrasing what they said, but I'm doing that in my head. I'm doing it as I read. I don't necessarily do it paragraph by paragraph. I do it at any moment that I feel like I need to stop and reassess what's been said and where we're at. And then I continue.
The paragraphs are nothing special on the LSAT.
Not special at all. Some are way too long.
In your writing, paragraphs should mean that there's like a meaningful, you know, there's a break, a new idea, a different topic, yep. You know, like the paragraphs should mean something. On the LSAT, it's like they're kind of thrown in there arbitrarily.
Yeah.
And frequently, as Ben mentioned, they're just way too long. So if you're waiting until the end of the first paragraph to sum it up and understand what was said, you don't need to test your short-term memory. You need to understand the damn passage.
If you understand it and actually get what the person is saying, you will remember it. That is because these ideas aren't out of this world. They're actually pretty straightforward. You're just like, oh, this is what you're saying? Okay, I get it. Continue with your conversation. Imagine having a conversation with your friend that was 15 sentences long. It's not like you'd be like, oh, well, I got to take some notes here. Can we hold up?
Right. Yeah, you'd be listening. You'd be engaging. And, yep. I also want, I don't like this idea. Notice that she says, enhance your ability to read a text and not impart outside information onto it.
But we do that all the time. That's how you process information.
Who told you that outside information is irrelevant? I mean, when I'm answering a question, I'm going to be answering questions based on what was said in the passage. But as I'm reading the passage, you better fucking believe that I'm going to bring in all kinds of outside information in order to contextualize it and to understand what they're saying. There's no instructions on the LSAT that say turn off all outside information, like disavow all knowledge of the universe outside of the test.
Yeah, it become say a, that. A blank computer. That's
it
like,
doesn't say that.
That's has no not, understanding of the world. Yeah,
that is not what we're doing. So wherever you learned that, you can forget about that. That's not.
Let me give an example of this so that people can understand what we mean by this. So the other day I was reading a reading comp passage in class. And it was talking about how the world was getting cooler. The Northern Hemisphere was getting cooler over the last 50 or 40 years or whatever. And I kept saying in the class, I'm like, well, that's bizarre to me because I kind of was under the impression that the world has been getting warmer. And I would assume that the Northern Hemisphere was also getting warmer, but maybe not. It's not like I took that outside information and put it into the passage and pretended that the passage was actually saying that the Northern Hemisphere was getting warmer. I was just saying, I understand what the passage is saying, and that's surprising to me given what I know about the world. And it helped me understand or put in context what the passage is saying, which is ultimately what they're going to test us on. But it's not like I was ignoring the passage. It just gave me context.
100%. When we're reading comprehension passages, we should be analogizing to outside stuff all the time.
Oh, I should say too, at the end of that passage, it actually said, oh, and by the way, it may not actually have been the case that the Northern Hemisphere got colder. It may have stayed the same or gotten warmer or something like that. And I was like, oh, well, look at that. That kind of goes along with my expectation. But they acknowledged that, and I was aware of that. I was hypersensitive to that acknowledgement because of my contention with the passage all along.
Perfect.
Hey there. Welcome to the LSAT Demon Daily. I'm Matt Dumont, an LSAT teacher and tutor at the LSAT Demon, and now a rising 3L at the University of Maryland. With me is Pushkar Chobel, a teacher and tutor at the LSAT Demon, and someone who's about to start law school at Columbia in the fall. How's it going, Pushkar?
Doing great. Thanks, Matt. How are yourself?
I'm good. You excited to start school?
I am pumped. There's mixed feelings, but it's mostly good.
Mostly good. Yeah, that sounds about right. Awesome. So we got an email today from A that says, "Hi, team. First, I would like to say how grateful I am for these free classes and material you all publish, such as the one-hour LSAT class I just attended." Awesome, you're welcome. Take advantage of all the free materials that we provide. He says, here's my question for y'all. I wonder if taking a gap year to space out LSAT prep and work as a software engineer after graduating this fall would be a good idea before entering law school. I'll be turning 27 in August, and if I achieve a high 170 score, I will be applying this September. If I don't achieve that score, I will take the gap year regardless to make sure that I reach the score I want and apply early and broadly. I'm not sure if there's any implicit age bias in OCIs, that's on-campus interviews, and summer associate hirings, and would like to know your opinion. I'm probably overthinking this, as hiring managers won't be able to tell the difference between a graduating 31 or 32-year-old. Still, I am curious if y'all know of any age bias in the industry. Thanks so much for all the advice, and a shout out to the Demon team for doing what they do. You all make the test fun by showing how easy it is. All the best. Hey, I think there's a lot of great questions in there. And so, Pushkar, I'm going to turn it right over to you. What do you think?
Sounds good. Thank you, Matt. Well, first of all, A, great job making use of our materials and, you know, keep taking advantage of all that content that we put out there. I will say my initial inclination here is that, you know, if you're going into law school at around the age 27, 28 range, that's really not going to be that old for big law. And if anything, that's going to be a strength. It means that you've had some years of experience. You had, what is that, like 5 or 6 years of work experience at this point. You've been working in teams. You have problem solving experience. These are definitely going to be pluses on your application. So I would not be spooked by this at all. If anything, big law, it's going to make you more attractive for big law, again, in this kind of range.
Yeah, I want to agree with a lot of the points that you just said. I think that having substantive work experience can be really beneficial. I know that it's some of the things that got me jobs for summer things. Now, I didn't do summers at firms. That's just not where I went with my career. It's not where I'm going with my career. But I know plenty of people who are working at firms right now who are 5, 6, 8 years out of school before they went to law school. So I agree. I think that there's some real benefit there to having work experience. And do you want to speak about the hiring manager thing, what they can talk about.
Yeah, I mean, that's not going to make a huge difference. They're not really going to be able to tell. All they're looking for, again, is on your resume, do you have substantive good work experience? And, you know, it's a very, very small factor in the grand scheme of things, right? The things that really do matter for big law recruitment are, where, you know, what school you go to, how well you do in your class, you know, what kind of extracurriculars are you in? Are you on law review? That kind of thing. So these factors are going to weigh much, much higher than any kind of age bias.
Yeah, I think there's maybe a parallel there. Where we keep talking about, like, hey, show up with your best LSAT score. And I think A is on that train in order to get into law school. In order to get into big law, if you show up with, like, you're in the top 5% of your class, they're not going to care, again, so much about your age because you're showing up with the scoreboard, right? Like Nathan says, scoreboard, I got my 170 plus, whatever. They're going to be looking at your grades and, like you said, the law review. Those kind of things are so much more important than a year gap year. I also want to point out that, like, this person being 27 or 28 when they start is right within the average of what people go to law school with. The sort of average age is like 24 to 28. There are certainly people that go straight from K through JD, but there's plenty of people that get another degree before they go to law school or work for 5-6 years before they go to law school. And so I don't even think this person is necessarily old.
I totally agree with you. I'm 25 now. I'm starting law school in the fall. I took 4 years off to work and get some work experience. And I think that's part of why I got in, you know, into a decent school is because, like, I had, you know, I have a track record, but I've done well in an industry. So I'm much, you know, you're a less riskier bet than someone who hasn't had that work experience.
Yeah. And now, again, that's not to say that people don't go straight through and don't have wild success, you know, being a 21-year-old in law school and doing those kind of things. But I think the law schools find benefit from a diverse classroom based on work experience. And so are the law firms. They're going to go, oh, this person knows how to get stuff done on a deadline because they've worked in this kind of capacity. Great. And I think software engineer, right? Like, this person is a software engineer. I think that that's going to be beneficial experience to a lot of places, especially if they want to go into any sort of technical lawyering, like that kind of stuff. So I want to add a caveat to the age sort of bias thing. Now, of course, age bias is illegal. You're not allowed to not hire someone because of their age. But I think that is a factor they're going to consider. If they know, for instance, that you're 40 or 45, that doesn't mean they're not going to hire you even at a big law firm. But I think it's going to cross their mind that you might not have as long of a career at that firm of like 30 years compared to a person who's in their 20s or even early 30s. I think that when you start getting like a decade over what this person is talking about, then it might become a factor they consider, but I still don't think it's going to eliminate you from consideration.
Absolutely.
Any additional thoughts for this person on this issue?
Just to recap here, right? You know, if you're talking about the 27, 28 year old range, it's not going to be a huge factor. I don't think you should be stressing about this at all. You're coming with really good work experience as a software engineer. It shows me you've worked in teams before. You have problem solving skills. You're detail oriented. These are all very big pluses that are going in your direction. So, don't stress out about this at all.
Yeah, I want to double down on this. And if anything, you're approaching this from the right way, take the gap year to get your best LSAT score so that you're a different type of candidate. And so that will open up these doors to the jobs that you're interested in. That is going to have a much bigger impact on your availability to the big law jobs, more so than this extra year of waiting. So much more. Okay, awesome. Just want to say thanks to A for writing in. Pushkar, always a pleasure to see you and be on the pod with you. I hope that you have a great fall coming up, yeah?
Thanks, man. I appreciate it. I hope you have a great summer as well.
Thanks.
This email is from Gregory.
Hello. First, I wanted to express my sincere gratitude for your show. As a first gen with no family or relatives in the legal field, I have found solace in thinking LSAT. Thank you. Oh, I guess this came into our other show. But anyway, we're going to talk about it here on the daily.
Okay.
I just finished my diagnostic exam and I scored a 133. I wanted to ask if 157 plus within 3 months is a realistic plan. What does your gut say about that, Ben?
I'm concerned. Starting with a 133 is lower than most people. Most people are starting in the 140s. So within 3 months, go up more than 20 points. I don't know. It's definitely possible. I'm not optimistic.
Yeah. I mean, realistic. Let's take a quick side note here.
Definition of realistic.
Yeah. Realistic. Having or showing a sensible and practical idea of what can be achieved or expected. Second definition, representing familiar things in a way that is accurate or true to life. I don't know. Do you think that this is, would you call this a sensible or practical idea of what can be achieved or expected? Just means it's possible.
Yeah, it's possible.
But expected.
I wouldn't say this is expected. I wouldn't say, okay, hey, let's put our money on this table. I'd love to see you drill and then take another practice test and hopefully see that bump up pretty quickly here. That would give me more confidence. But until we see that, I think you're going to have a longer road ahead just based on the information we have right now. Also, I don't know how significant this is, but your email, you lowercase I, which is just a stylistic choice, but it seems, I don't know. I'm concerned that you need a little more attention to detail to really kind of bump up this test.
Yeah, people toss these emails off on their phone or whatever, and they don't bother anymore with punctuation and things like that. Mm-hmm. But you are, Gregory, getting yourself into a lawyerish type of a field. You're talking to two people who did go to law school. And if you're talking to us about law school admissions, you might want to get in the habit of just being a little bit more professional with your communications. We appreciate you writing in. Thank you for asking us for help. That's a bit of unsolicited advice, I guess. I want to make it clear that if you're scoring 133, you are understanding almost nothing about the test. You think you're understanding some things, like the ones that you got right. You think you understood them, and maybe you understood one or two, but you're adding very little value over what you would expect from random guessing. 133 is just not that much better than random guessing. I would guess that you're probably getting like 4 or 5 questions more than just random guessing per section. So you're like, job one, Gregory, stop thinking about 157 plus. Instead, let's think about 140. What's it going to take to get to 140? To get to 140, Gregory, you need to start getting the first 5 right in every section, like no mistakes in the first 5. And if you can do that, then maybe you can get the first 6 or 7 or, eventually 10 right. But if you could just get the first 10 in each section, you'd already be like knocking on the door of 150. I'm not like trying to beat you up, Gregory. I just want to be realistic about this, that because you literally asked me to be realistic. To be realistic, you have to start understanding what you're doing. And at 133, you're not. You would be scoring 150 if you were understanding the first 10 in each section. So you got to slow way down. You got to focus only on accuracy, not speed at all. And you've got to start getting them right instead of getting them wrong, which means you've got to be more careful. You've got to read it really carefully. You have to understand what they're asking you. You have to feel good about the right answers. You have to see why the wrong answers are wrong. And if you could just do that, again, I'm not bullshitting, Gregory. the first 10 questions in each section, if you were able to answer the first 10 correctly,
mm-hmm.
you'd already be 15 points higher than where you're at right now. So that's what we have to be thinking about, is just slow, calm, careful, accurate, solve the questions, actually understand what they're asking you. Right now, you're skimming the surface and you're understanding almost nothing. Anything you want to add to any of that?
Nope, I agree.
Second, I transferred to my current institution where I'll receive my diploma with a very low GPA. My freshman year was great. I had an overall 3.3 GPA. Okay, that's not great for people who are going to law school. In fact, most of our students would say that sucks. like most people who are going to law school are like, yeah, I had that one real bad semester when I got a 3.3. Since transferring, I done my best to raise my GPA and average at least a 3.1 within the last 3.5 years. I know I can graduate with at least a 2.9. So there's, doesn't even make sense, right? Because where's the bad, there are some bad semesters that Gregory's not talking about here.
They must be pretty bad because the average of the 3.3 and the 3.1 is somehow now becoming 2.9. So
he's trying to work his way back up to 2.9.
Well, so you have like a 2.5 or something now, or what's going on?
Yeah, he's a 2.something something trying to make it up to 2.9, which just doesn't indicate to this. Again, I mean, I hate to be so like blunt about it, but that does not demonstrate that you're good at school. And you're applying to school. So the schools look at that and they go, okay, so this person is not that good at school. Do we want them to come to our school? Like that's.
And the only schools that are willing to do that are not actually in the business of teaching students. They're in the business of making money off of students who probably shouldn't be there.
Yeah. Gregory continues. I'm aiming for some schools that I have found will most likely accept me with these credentials, which just sounds like bottom feeding types of schools that are willing to soak you, Gregory, for $40,000, $50,000 a year. And they don't really care that much about your potential for success. With this understanding of my academic background, could you tell me, based on your experiences, if 157 is achievable within the next 3 months? I want to be applying for school in fall of 2023. I want to be as realistic as possible so I do not incur too much debt. Thank you, Gregory. Gregory, do not pay for law school. Do not pay one penny of tuition. Don't do it. Don't pay for law school. If you can't get a scholarship, don't go at all.
I mean, Gregory, the numbers you're giving us are 133 on your LSAT and somewhere below a 2.9 on your GPA. You have to increase your LSAT score dramatically to prove to yourself that this is a path you want to follow. If you can't do this, let the LSAT tell you that you need to stay away and find something else.
Yeah, this is the exact tragedy. You know, it's like the looming car accident.
Yeah.
And it's just like, no, 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 don't do it. You know, like,
yeah,
avoid, like, don't do this. Like whatever he says, I want to be as realistic as possible so I do not incur too much debt. Well,
how about zero debt?
Yeah, the number is zero, Gregory. If you spend a penny on law school, you're wasting your money. So get a scholarship or don't go at all. Go to lsatdemon.com/scholarships. Put in your realistic GPA. I mean, what is it actually? 2.8, 2.7? Put that in there and then put in various LSAT scores and see what you would need to get a scholarship, a full scholarship. I think that there are some real low ranked schools that would probably still give you a full ride if you make it to 160 or 165 or whatever it is. Is that realistic within 3 months? No. Is it possible? Yes. Is it expected? Absolutely not.
No.
I don't think that you should be, you know, trying to apply this fall. I think that this is going to be, if it's going to ever work out for you, I think that this is going to be another year endeavor. You're still doing your undergrad classes. You need to be getting straight A's, not A minuses, straight A's. Because you have to demonstrate to the schools that you're good at school. Right now, you're demonstrating to the schools that you're bad at school.
Well, demonstrate to the schools, yes, but demonstrate to yourself too, Gregory. Don't prove to yourself that this is a path you want to pursue and can pursue, and then make it happen. I don't think you've proven it to yourself yet.
We have an email here from F.
Good morning. As a rising senior at my current institution, I am planning on applying to law school this September. I'm wondering how GPA calculations work for students like me that are applying while still in school. I'm under the impression that if I apply this cycle, there is still a whole year of grades that are not accounted for. I know that in my last year of school, I can easily get straight A's and raise my GPA. Will my senior year grades matter if I apply this cycle? If I know my GPA can go up, is it smarter to wait until the next cycle when all my grades are accounted for? Have we ever told someone not to wait?
Yeah, it's always a good idea to wait. It's I'm not saying it's, you know, a bad idea to apply right now necessarily. I just know that it's not a bad idea to wait. And if you know, this F, you have a specific reason. You're telling me that if you get straight A's, you are going to raise your GPA. Well, then you're going to look like a better applicant next cycle. If you apply this cycle, you're going to apply with whatever your GPA is. I mean, LSAC's going to calculate it. And law schools will look at your final transcripts before you start school, but they will be deciding whether they're going to admit you or not based on your existing GPA.
When they make that decision, they have to make it based on the information that they have at the time. Maybe you can update them right before they make a decision, but you're still not going to have all your grades in because they're making that decision in fall.
Yeah. So why not just wait? Sure seems like you could just wait. I mean,
wait,
you
take get a higher year. LSAT score.
Yeah. I don't see why you would be trying to rush into this. Think about if there's somebody who's pushing you to do this, you know. If it's your mom and dad, it's like, well, mom and dad, I mean, I'm going to wait a year, though, because I'm going to get a better scholarship to law school / I'm going to get into a better school.
Yeah. Hey, mom and dad, I'd like to save $150,000. So I'm going to wait a year. And we're opposed to that. We'd like you to.
If it's some admissions flack, you know, they're like trying to push you into it because they want your application right now or they want your money for application consulting or whatever. What? Law schools will still be there in another year, but I'll be showing up with a higher GPA and potentially higher LSAT, and I'll be a better candidate. I mean, you could be a transformatively better candidate. Go to LSATdemon.com/scholarships, you know, play with, hey, if you're raising your GPA from a 3.8 to a 3.9, or from a 3.3 to a 3.4, whatever it is, you know, play with those numbers and see what it does to your scholarship estimates. But that in combination with a few more points of LSAT, I guarantee that it's going to transform your opportunities. So it's almost like you'd be crazy not to wait.
Yeah.
Hey there, welcome to LSAT Demon Daily. I am Eric. I am a recent addition to the LSAT Demon's teaching corps. With me is one of the veterans of the teaching and tutor team at LSAT Demon, Francesca. How are you doing today, Francesca?
I'm great, thanks. I don't know if I'd call myself a veteran, but I guess as more people go off and do law school and join the real world, maybe I'll be getting up there. How are you doing, Eric?
I'm doing well. Yeah, that is the inspiring thing as a new teacher with the Demon to see those that came before going off to Harvard and Yale and all sorts of amazing schools that I can only aspire to.
Absolutely. It's very inspiring for sure.
As a newer teacher with the Demon, I look to people like yourself for wisdom and advice. And recently in our Slack chat, you had brought up something that you see as kind of a red flag that you learned to look for early on in students that you work with.
Yeah, absolutely. It's funny that you bring up being a new teacher or tutor, because I remember that a big thing that I was feeling when I first started out with the Demon was I had this sort of fear of when I went into tutoring sessions that the students that I was tutoring were just going to be going through the questions more quickly than me, that they would understand what was going on more quickly than me, and that'd be sort of left in the dust. And I always wanted to know the questions in advance so that I could prepare that so that that wouldn't happen. But recently, I've been doing more a process of going through the questions where I'm seeing them for the first time myself, as well as the students. And I've noticed that what I used to think of as my worst nightmare, which is that the student would go through the question more quickly than me, is actually kind of a red flag that I look for now, because it's really a big sign that if the student is reading through the question and jumping into the answer choices more quickly than me, and I'm still thinking, oh my gosh, I didn't understand anything of that passage, we need to go through that again, the odds are that they don't fully understand it themselves either. It's a common misconception to want to make up time on reading the passage or the stimulus or the rules or whatever it is more quickly, because you think that that's how you're going to get through more sections. But that is exactly how you blunder through sections and make errors that you didn't need to make. And you and I both know the key is really to spend more time on the passage, and speed is something that will come later on and in different parts of the test.
For sure. And this is true of all of the sections, right? I mean, you're talking not just about LR, but also reading comp and logic games. I've only been teaching classes so far in logic games, but I generally in classes give enough time for the group to put together what I think is a solid diagram of worlds before getting to the questions, and just try to say, hey, I'm giving you the time to approach this setup, but really don't worry if you don't get to the questions. And yeah, I have to imagine that those who actually do take the 6 or 7 minutes or whatever it is that I give in class to get through all of the questions in like a level 4, level 5 game, probably didn't take the time to get through their setup in a helpful and meaningful way.
Mm-hmm, exactly. And it's very much the same on logical reasoning and reading comprehension, which are two classes that I teach, shameless plug, Fridays, 2:30 to 3:30 Eastern for RC workshop, and then 5 to 6 p.m. Eastern for my Argue Like a Lawyer class for LR. But in those classes, the approach that I really try to model and that I try to get students to practice and give them feedback on is to take the passages one sentence at a time. And it's like that classic saying, how do you eat an elephant one bite at a time? That's what we're trying to do here. If you can't make sense of the sentences individually, if you can't sort of put them into your own words, make sense of them in common sense English, like the type of language that you would talk to a ninth grader with, then you're not going to understand them when they're put together. So when you see me reading very slowly and carefully through a passage and getting really into the weeds and coming up with my own examples, making up connections to different parts of the passage, that's the approach that we're going for here. And that's how you really push yourself into a higher score band. The people who are scoring in the high 170s, they're not doing so because they're reading really quickly. They're doing so because often they're reading more slowly, more carefully, and they've really taken the time over their study journey to nail down the process of being very accurate on every single question. And then when it comes to evaluating answer choices, they're able to do that much more quickly and effectively because they know what they're looking for.
Mm-hmm. Now, when you spot this red flag in students who you work with, whether it's in a class or in a one-on-one setting, and you, let's say they finish the question faster than you would, how does that heart-to-heart with them go in talking about this? And do you find that there's resistance, or does it take people a long time to understand the point that, hey, you need to slow down? Like, is that a hard lesson for people to learn?
Sometimes, but I think that the easiest way to break down that barrier is to just say, hold on a second, I did not understand anything of that passage. If I didn't understand it, I'm not sure how much you understood. Let's try to break it down together.
Yeah, I think it's really powerful and useful for people who might be newer to their LSAT study to hear someone like yourself who has already been through the process of studying and already has an amazing LSAT score on record to come out and say, yeah, I struggle with this sometimes too. You know, if you're really reading for understanding, it's going to take a lot of focus and time. And I could admit that sometimes I get to the end of a passage or the end of a LR prompt and think, wait, what? I need to go over that again. So accepting that that's going to happen, just admitting that I didn't get that, I got to go over it again, and that will be worth the time it takes, I think that's crucial.
Exactly. I couldn't agree more.
The one other thing that I, along these lines, have, I think, spoken to a couple students about is just trusting that you're going to take the time that you need to understand and get things right. So I remember from when I was studying, I reached a point where there was maybe not an arrogance that I felt, but certainly a confidence in knowing that, hey, I'm good at this. If I run into a question that I'm struggling with and it feels like it's taking me a long time, I trust that I'm taking as long as I need to get this right. And that's going to pay off on the back end. So that is one of the things that I've tried to speak to students about, is just having that feeling of like trust in yourself that you're smart enough to get it. It might feel like it's taking a lot of time, but you're taking the time that is necessary, and that is what you have to do.
Totally. It's trust in yourself and it's trust in the process. And I say this to students all the time when they say, I feel like I should be going faster. I always say, I don't care what you think you should be doing. I don't care where you think you should be at. I care about where you're at right now and how we can make this question make more sense to you right now.
All right, one more question for you. As someone who has been through the process of studying for the LSAT, has already got a really good LSAT score and is now teaching it, do you still ever find yourself worried about time?
That's a good question.
Is there any part of you that is still like, oh crap, this is taking me a long time?
If I had to guess, I would say yes. I haven't done a time section in a while or like a full test, but I, you know, putting myself in the situation, I'm sure that if I were faced with doing a time section or I needed to perform under time conditions, yeah, there would be a voice in the back of my head saying, why can't you be doing this faster? Why can't you be going faster on this? But it's just a matter of training that voice to quiet down and say, hold on, that voice is not helping me. That voice is not helping me do better on this test. The only thing that's going to help me do better is to spend my energy not on thinking about the clock, not on thinking about, you know, the little test anxieties that I have going on, and just thinking, what's in front of me and how can I make it make sense? That's all there is to it.
Email daily at LSATdemon.com if you'd like to ask us a question or share some LSAT or law school admissions news. Thanks for listening.